Dr. Maple Go, and welcome to Dr. Not Otherwise Specified, also known as Dr. NOS. This podcast is to provide guidance for our junior doctors to navigate medical and non-medical careers. I hope all the doctors out there can get something out of this, whether they're specified or not. Kia pai tora. Hara mai to another episode of Dr. NOS. Today we have Dr. Carl Horsley, who is an intensive care specialist at Middlemore Hospital in Auckland. Having previously completed training in emergency medicine, he's also the clinical lead for system safety at the Health Quality and Safety Commission, with a focus on understanding the way in which the wider healthcare system shapes the conditions in which care is provided. He has recently completed a Master's in Science in Human Factors and Systems Safety at Lund University, Sweden, and is part of the Resilient Healthcare Society, an international collaboration of researchers, clinicians, and safety scientists. His current focus is on how to bring together te ao Māori and modern safety science to create a system that supports good care at all levels. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today, Carl.
Good, mate. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So I thought we might start with the basics. So tell us how you got into medicine.
I guess I got to the end of school and didn't really know what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine decided that he didn't want to do engineering. And so we both agreed we'd do medicine together. He's now a cardiologist in my kind of hospital. And here I am. Whenever I ask people this, usually they say I was good at science and I wanted to help people. It's a classic answer. And there probably was some of that. But medicine was kind of something I fell into. I'd never really thought much of biology and stuff. And then I got into doing some study and just loved it. And it was just really interesting and really liked the way it worked and being able to do practical stuff. It was something I ended up doing, but at the end I fell in love with it. Yeah. And I think for many of us, we go into medicine not really knowing what it is. We don't really have an idea about it at all. And we have this idea from the media or people we know, but it's not the reality of the world.
Out of curiosity, where did you study?
I did the intermediate at Waikato, and then I was at Otago and then Christchurch Med School again, and then ended up Blenheim first year in Melbourne a couple of years, and then back to mainly Middlemore in the Auckland region since about 98. So yeah, finished all my training off in Auckland.
Wow. Yeah. How did you get into, because I see you were an emergency medicine specialist to start with, and then now you've done ICU as well. So how did you pick one career and then the next career?
So I think there's this mythology that we all pick careers because we, you know, Pooh Bear came to me in a dream at 3 and said, you will be a surgeon or whatever. But actually, the reality of most of us is we do a specialty because we like the people. Someone was nice to us and said, I believe in you, come and do it. And that was the same for me. Emergency medicine, Anne-Marie Kelly, a professor of emergency medicine, offered me a job in Melbourne, then encouraged me. And I ended up doing ED because someone was nice to me. I love the chaos and I love being able to help people, and that was great. And when I finished ED, someone else was nice to me and said, come and do ICU, be a fellow for a while. And I went there and, yeah, I fell in love with that. So I guess for me, the decisions we make along the way are sometimes, in retrospect, we tell ourselves these stories about how it was always obvious we were going to end up. But often it's just we meet people along the way and we go, I like that person. I like what they do. I like the way they see the world. But I guess it's a bigger point about how do we decide what to do. And I guess for your listeners, it's very commonly we make those questions so small. We say, what specialty do I want to do rather than what's the life I want, or what are my values, what calls out to me? And I guess along the way, we're muddling through with purpose, you know, seeing where we go and where we end up. And sometimes it's in places we never imagined we'd be.
Was there something about ICU that resonated with your values or resonated with the kind of person or lifestyle you wanted to lead?
I think for me, when I was in emergency medicine, I loved that first bite of the diagnostic apple. The fresh, you know, especially when you've been a med student, you're told to go and see the person for the fourth time and then you're a bit over it. And in ED, you suddenly get to make a diagnosis and work stuff out, do procedures and set people in the right direction and feel like you're making a difference. And that was really good. But I, towards the end of that, noticed there was this pressure to really churn through the numbers to get people through, to rule out stuff rather than to answer their questions as to why they were there. And for people who know me, I'm a bit of a slow, ponderous thinker. So I got to ICU and it had many things I loved about ED in terms of working in teams, coming together with purpose, you know, this collective purpose of what are we trying to do here, but also time for conversations that mattered with families, the ability to think about how do we create a future for this person or can we create a future for this person. And then again about the how do I make this team work, how do I build the system to work better. So a lot of things I'd love to need there, but then another level as well in terms of thinking about some of these other issues.
When you transitioned from ED to ICU, how far along your training were you, and was it difficult to go back to training? I hear that SMOs often find it a hard time going back to being a registrar.
Yeah, I finished my training. So I was 30 and I finished my ED training. I come through quickly. But I was offered a couple of jobs as specialist, but went did the fellow job instead. The first 5 years of any SMO job are working out what the job is. There's this mythology, you finish your training and you're all prepared and it's all fabulous, and that's just not true. So you spend the first 5 years working out what the job is. And then I think after that time, it is hard to go back and be a trainee. One of my good friends is going back to some pediatrics right now, and I think it's been a struggle to go back from being a specialist to being a trainee again. And so for me, it was not too jarring. It was just a continuation on, but yeah.
I just wonder, with your work in ICU, can you tell us a little bit about your day-to-day and what it pans out, what your week looks like?
So the joy of ICU is it can still be all over the place. In theory, we do 57 hours a week, so it's quite a lot of hours, a lot of that being available. So about once a week, I'll do a 24-hour call where I'm on site. That's not 24 hours at the bedside. I'll get some sleep in there or talking, but that's really bringing together the team around the ward round, looking at the patients in the unit, planning for what we can do, coming up with plans to get this patient better, liaising with other teams and working with them to try and work out what we can do and supervising all that stuff, responding to resuscitation. In minimal ICU, we are a small ICU with a big service, which means we help in the care of people in the ED, but also the wards through our PAR team. And so it's really keeping an eye on the system as a whole, the hospital as a whole, in terms of what's going on, providing extra support, whether that's an extra SMO or whatever it is. And then also times talking to families, make sure they understand where we are, where we go, what's happened, answering their questions, and making sure that they feel part of that care. And that's really hard with COVID. It's been really difficult. And then really just keeping the unit running operationally in terms of where we're going. So that's the on-call day. The other bits are we all have other clinical duties, but also being involved in education, being involved in learning reviews of different cases we've had, thinking about I'm involved in the simulation team. So there's a whole lot of non-clinical stuff that goes on as well about really how do we grow a team and a service that meets the needs of the patients that we have and their families. So it's a really interesting, diverse work. And the best thing with ICU is it can be anything you want to be. And I guess that's one of the key things for wherever you end up, is it's not, you don't have to be defined by the job you think it is. As you become a specialist, there's a lot more scope to be able to create the job that you want. And it will look different to different people. And it will look different to you at different times in your career.
For you, what's the balance you've striked now in terms of the work you're doing in ICU and all the extra stuff that you're doing around it?
I don't know if I'd ever use balance as a phrase, but I do a day a week for the commission. Yeah, so what is it, work-life integration? I think it's, for me, so I do 4 days a week clinical, about 1 in 3, 1 in 4 weekends, and then a day a week of that is commission work. And that's a good balance because it means that I can try and have that day just thinking about the commission, the bigger system, thinking about how do we go at that sort of national level problems. And then the rest of the time keeps me very grounded in the realities of what it's like to work in a busy hospital. And so those two different lenses on the system are really useful. So, yeah, it's, in theory, it's about 57 hours a week, sometimes more, sometimes less.
What are the shifts like in ICU? Are you working like 8 to 8 or?
It's in flux. On the weekends, we do 24-hour call, and that's fine because it's not so busy. We will do 12-hour shifts during the week, day shift and a night shift, but that's, we're changing that around at the moment. I think the thing to remember is that 12 hours as a registrar is a lot harder than 12 hours as a specialist often. It's a different role. So our role is more strategic. We've got oversight of what's going on, but we're not necessarily running to every core doing those sort of things. Yeah, we start at 8, we hand over at 8 o'clock in the evening, but if it's busy, we'll stay late. If it's in the weekends, we may be on site all the time, but it's not, it can be really busy in some shifts and other shifts can be okay. It can be hard.
Can you tell us a little bit about whether you do any more ED? It sounds like ED is a chapter that's closed for you.
Yeah, I think you can do two things. Three things is pretty hard. And I think for me, I've chosen to get into the safety science stuff the more. And ED was, I've just retired my fellowship. So I think ED was it was part of the journey I've taken to get to where I am, but I wouldn't go back there now. And I think for me, ICU is just that that pace and that focus and that pilot system, it just suits me. So I wouldn't go back to UD now. So yeah, no, it's a very pleasant memory, but a close chat.
Fair enough. And one of the parts that strikes me about ICU is the number of difficult conversations you have. And part of that also, I think, because of the conditions you see, the level of burnout that people experience in ICU. I'm just wondering if you could speak to any of that.
It's really weird. When you start off, first when I started my training, I was always like, I got an intubation. I did a central line. I did nightline. I was excited. Got to see this weird condition. It was great. And after a while, those things become very routine. And now the good parts of the job are a good death, where everyone understands what's going on. We're clear on the values that the patient has, so we understand what we can and what we can't do. And we're caring for the patient, but in a way that focuses on the outcome, you know, they're not going to survive this outcome, this event. And that's okay. And the difficult conversations, you know, family meetings, talking to whānau, getting people to understand what's going on and understanding the concerns and being able to work together. That's the best part of the job. So these difficult conversations, to me, they're really privileged. To be part of people's really difficult times, and to try and make them just less awful is a really big deal. And that's the thing I just love. I really love the chance to sit with families at their most difficult time and help navigate what's going on, to not drive the destination for them, but to help them make sense of it, and to help them see what's going on, what's important to them, and to respond to them in that moment about that conversation. That's a really good thing to me. So I find that is one of the more nourishing parts of the role. And so I don't look at those conversations as being the hard part of the job. I actually look at them now as being one of the best parts of the job. But it's something you have to pay attention to, and you have to practice, and you have to think about what you're doing. And that's great. In terms of burnout, I think it's ED and ICU recognizes two areas of high burnout. But I have to say that I think most areas in healthcare are really subjected to the same stresses to different degrees at different times. And COVID has certainly put a lot more load on the system for everybody. To me, I see burnout as a system problem. It's not about individuals. It's about the place we work, how well it is designed to support good care. And where I work, I feel that the team as well is designed to support good care. You know, we look after each other. We look after our families. I'm proud of the care that we provide. And so I feel uplifted by that work. The frustrations of not being able to provide good care come from this kind of productive focus and the limitations of resource and the bed state and the capacity and this. That's something that's there for all of us, and that's been there for a long time. But I guess for me, is that my focus is probably now less on how do I make sure that I am part of creating a system that supports people to provide good care. So much more focused on the positive about how do we build wellbeing into what we do. And I don't mean through pizza and resilience programs and all those things. I'm designing work systems that support people, that understand their realities, that provide tools to help them, that give them work that's interesting, that makes the best use of their expertise or their curiosity or whatever it is. And we find most of our registrars who come and work with us in minimalized years, you know, they're these amazingly intelligent people who are brilliant, and you just give them space and support and they do crazily great things. And if they know more about something than I do, that's fantastic. I want you to be better than I am, for sure. And for all of us, I think it's less about how do we prevent burnout, more about how do we create spaces so people feel valued and seen and can contribute. And so this taps much more to the work about psychological safety and Amy Ibbotson's work on high-performing teams, on models of distributive leadership, of thinking about things like human factors and design, about how do we build tools that support people in the work they do and understanding the realities of the work as people do it, not the way we think they do it. So I guess is that my current focus when I think about burnout is much more about how do we support good work? How do we support people to do good work?
Because it sounds like you've got a lot of passion driving around your human factors and system safety, and it's something that's hit home for you. How did that come about in the first place? And tell me a bit about the work you're doing at the moment.
If you told me when I started this that I'd do safety work, I would have probably poked my own eyes out, followed by someone else. Just safety was always this thing that was done to people. Here's the rules. You didn't follow the rules, off you go. And this kind of model of safety is this disembodied procedure that was written somewhere, and that was what safety was. And so for me, I've been on a journey to reframe my whole understanding of safety. So this came about, I got really into simulation, with team simulation, and the ICU. How do we build a team that can deal with a 2.5-kilogram child and a 350-kilogram septic shock patient a bit more? How do we prepare our teams to work well together? And as part of that, we were looking at you know, how people felt after a recess that didn't go well and how team performance affected that. And so through that, I got to understand really about how knocked around people were when they were bold at this event, when they thought if we just had done that better, then this patient would have been okay. And so I got really interested then about, well, how do we build high-functioning teams? How do we support work? But also, what is the way people feel? Tell us about the way that they understand safety. And so for me, I've come to now understand that safety is about our ability to safely navigate risk. It's not about the fact that the system's perfect and don't step up. It's about this idea that how do we support people as they navigate the risk here and looking after people with these big complex systems. For me, it was driven by the fact that I saw that staff were really knocked around by adverse events. Families obviously were devastated by them. And that the current approaches really were very limited in helping us progress that at all. And so that's really taken me on to understand a lot of these ideas and then to do formal study in them and the research aspects of that. I guess it's been a long journey with a totally different meaning about what safety is at the start, what it is at the end. But for now, I think safety is really about how do we support at all levels of the system good care. No, that's pretty much it.
What are the practical implications of it? What are the things that you guys have implemented in Middlemore, for example, when it comes to system safety?
So the first thing is, when you think about how do we support good care, it means you have to understand very deeply about what people are actually doing and why they're doing it. So rather than going people telling them they're doing it wrong, you have to go and just be curious. You have to stand with people and say, tell me about your world. What are you doing? What's going on here? We saw this with our hand hygiene program. Rates went up massively when we actually took time to understand the way people were working, the trade-offs they were making, the things they had to navigate. So it really means being grounded in work is done, understanding what people, what work looks like for this person. So if you're a medical registrar in a hospital, what does your day look like? If I'm telling you to do 10 extra things, where do they fit? If I'm saying have a high quality end-of-life discussion with every patient, how are you going to do that when you've got 30 admissions coming through? So unless I understand the work as done, the realities of work, I cannot design things that will support good care. So that's the first thing. The second thing was really when we think about design is think about how do we create conditions that make success more likely. So very often we put in place more and more barriers, more forms to fill in, more procedures to do. You'll see an admission form has now 30 different pages. So every time there's a case, they add another page into it, different screening tools. And what you'll find is a whole lot of blank admission forms because they don't fit with that work. So rather than thinking about how to put more and more barriers to harm, it's thinking about how do we create the conditions that support people to be successful, to do good work. And the third thing we really is how do we build adaptive teams? So how do we build teams that can talk about the way they work, that can recognize what's going on? And that really is about, you know, being very clear about what is this care that we are trying to build together? How do I create space for everybody on this team to be part of that care? And that really feeds into ideas about psychological safety, about valuing your team, about understanding that you are situation dependent on the people you lead, and about also that it's not about people speaking up, it's about creating the space to be heard. And that's something you do every day.
Has it changed over time, the way you practice and the way you see your juniors?
Totally. It took us 3 years. But it's not just about what you say and do. It's also how you structure your rounds, the what you pay attention to, the way you use language. So it changes everything. For us, we took about 3 years and we did some feedback on that. And people felt that it had transformed the whole unit. So for our juniors, most of our juniors come into unit, find a welcoming place. They're part of the team. They feel that they can ask questions. And all those things, they sound soft and fluffy, but we now know from the work of Amy Edmondson and others that that's actually how you get a high-performing team, better outcomes. So better experience, better well-being, and better outcomes. It makes it a no-brainer. So I guess from my point of view is that when you take that kind of view about how do I create a space where people come to work and build value, then that changes everything. And I'm pretty sure most of your listeners will understand when they work on a unit that does that, makes them feel that way versus a unit that doesn't. They know how much effort they want to put in. They know what it's like to think about going to work the next day. They know what their focus is on in terms of the patients. It changes everything.
I've been on teams where I feel fundamentally valued by my seniors and by the entire construct of the team. But I've simultaneously also been on rotations where I certainly feel like I'm disposable and that my presence and my absence is not noticed. I wonder, when you're creating an environment or a culture where you want your team members to feel valued and seen, What are the things that you do?
The first thing is to be curious about others. So we have a no dickheads policy. You know, everything here is for the team. Our registrars get to meet Mama Tai, our awesome cleaner, who's our Gaua unit mascot. But the message is very much that you are here as part of our team. We welcome, this is Manakitanga, we welcome you to this place and here are our expectations on you. And so I think is that being curious about people, understanding who they are. We have mentors assigned to registrar that comes to us just to chat to, but they'll also have informal chats. We put time aside to just chat, to talk to each other, have a cup of coffee. But even the way that we think about things is really much like, what does this person need at this time to help them progress in their career? You're not disposed with a changeable, and every time we have new registrars, we say, oh, that last one was amazing. Well, there will never be a group as good as that. Then we get the new lot and go, this new group's amazing. We get such great trainees. But if you just take the time to know them and then create a space where they can blossom, it's great. It's wonderful to watch. So I think, but being curious about people, not just you're the registrar on the shift, you know, tell me about you. What are you excited about? What are you worried about? What's going on? I think, and that's that whole thing about being, it's a humanistic system. We're people on a system, but we're different people. We have to understand them.
I want so much for this to be emulated nationwide, and I get the feeling that it's quite unique to specific departments and specific teams and hospitals at the moment, so it's still a rare form. But I wanted to double back a little bit just to talk about your work in ICU and just to hear a bit about what you think are the highlights and the lowlights of working as an intensivist.
The highlights are the people you work with, and that includes patients at this, but all the other teams and stuff. So this idea of what is this care that we build together based on the values, based on situation, what is this thing that we build together? And this idea that, you know, the idea that I can fix someone in ICU who's really unwell on my own is nuts. It's patently not true. So this idea of being part of something bigger, that you can build this care for this person and have an amazingly good outcome, is fantastic. And we go on their journey with them. And so they're part of our work family when they're with us, and we're part of their family when they're with us. So that's definitely the highlight. And seeing people come back and say, we're so grateful for what you did. And it's really funny. Sometimes they say, oh, we will never forget you. And we're like, we really want you to forget us. We want you to get back to your life and to get back to the things that matter to you. We just over time. But I think that creating these good outcomes for people with, and sometimes people, they shouldn't have survived. They're so sick. And be able to see them down the line is really moving. It's great. That's why we do this. The lowlights, I think, are about reaching the ends of the 1990s model of production. It's production focused, see more patients, churn through more, with just a bit less resource, a bit more complexity. And so we have a low bed numbers with two national services, and that sense of who do I take, which patients do I need to take, who can get by without us, what care can I provide today based on the staffing we have. And I think that's something that it really is going on a lot of levels and drives a lot of the behaviours that we see. If we focus on how fast you see someone, how quickly you get done, then we also say we want equity, we also want patient experience to matter. We're structurally embedding one way of working while asking for something else. And so I guess for me, that's part of the bit that drives me into the national level stuff, is to say, what is it that keeps us in this way of thinking about care, and what can we change that then unlocks that kind of relational way of working across the board? So I think that's the hardest, but it's just, we still have this focus on production, just churn through the numbers and get more people through the widget, through the system. It's something we all struggle with, I think.
Do you think capacity will be something that you guys still will struggle with in 10 to 20 years, or will there be different challenges that will be facing your specialty then?
I think all services that currently exist will be changed in 10, 20 years. So the medicine I trained for is not the medicine I do now. Intensive care, you know, when I first trained, was all about how do we normalize numbers, make sure that everything's sitting in a nice normal range. And ICU now is about how do we do the least possible to get someone through this. So we accept, and technology changes things, and the systems we work in change things. So I don't know what intensive care will be like in 10, 20 years. My hope is that it will still be focused on meeting the needs of people at some of the most challenging times. But I think for all of us, it's changing so rapidly that it's really hard to know where we'll end up. But I think at its heart, intensive care has always been, from the 1950s, about teams of people with diverse skills coming together to fix complex problems. And I think that will probably still remain in its heart.
Do you think when you started intensive care, because it was so different to how you are practicing now, is there anything you wish you knew? Is there anything you wish you could tell trainees?
We have these conversations with trainees quite a lot. ICU is this itch that you can't stop scratching. So people often come from other specialties and they come into ICU and they go, oh, I really like it, but I'm going to go back and see. And then they go, I need to come back. I kind of miss it. And I guess one of the things that we always talk about is about, you know, well, what is the life you want? What are the values you bring to this work? And I guess for me, it was probably more of an understanding of that long-term view. I think when I came into IC at the start, I was very focused on, I didn't want to disappoint people by not working hard enough. I didn't want to let the team down. So I went on lots of courses when I had young kids and did all these things. And actually, you need to come back to, I think for any specialty really, about what does a good job look like? What does a good life look like? And so for me, in a sense, I think it would probably be just about, it's not all about you. There's a team of people to help you, and it's okay to ask for that help. And that was a really big lesson later on. And also the fact that you can't, it's a related issue, you have a situation dependent on the people that you work with. And so how do you build a system really that works well when you're not there? So that's the two things, I think. At the start, when you're a specialist, you feel like you have to have all the right answers and you have to be the answers for everybody else. Whereas after a while, you understand that you have a different role, which is to bring people together and create space for those viewpoints to come to be brought to bear on the problems we have. The main advice would probably be just to understand that you exist within a system and a team, and that's okay. You can still be who you are and bring everything you have to it.
And it sounds partly an acknowledgement that we don't exist in a vacuum, but also partly an exercise of drawing boundaries. And I just wonder, the other aspect to ICU which stands out to me is the incredibly tragic and sad stories of patients coming through. How do you not carry that weight with you going home and not be able to identify and to be compassionate about their situation, but not let it weigh you down the entire time that it stops you doing your job? How do you draw that line?
I'm never going to be one of these people who says I was home and I leave the place and those patients have nothing to do with me. That's just not how I'm wired. But the question is, you're involved in the emotional blast of other people's lives. And how do you keep your heart open enough to care and not so open that you can't see the next patient and help them? And I guess it really comes down to this difference between empathy. You know, I see myself in your situation, how that must be and how awful it is, to compassion, which is really about I understand where you are and I want to, and I'm going to convert that to action to try and make it less awful. And so for me, I think that grounding of what can I do that makes a bad time better is a very protective factor. And a friend of mine, Liz Crow, talks about the fact that I see you as a privilege, and the privilege comes from being able to do something to help. And so for me, that's the protective factor. What can I do? What can we do to make this shit situation better? I can't change why you end up here, but it sure as hell can try and make it better. Mm. And that has meaning to me, and because it has meaning, it's protective.
Have there been encounters that you've found hard to draw that line, to you've brought it home with you at any point?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. That's really, I mean, for all of us, we have cases of the death of children of the same age as their own kids, or a story where families can't be present because they have to go to work. And you just imagine how that must be for them, having to leave their relative and leave because they have no other option. There's lots of stories that you reflect on afterwards, and I think that's okay. But they're not all stories about I see myself in this person, and therefore that's why it's humble. It's more there's some things in the system that really aren't right. And those are the ones that I reflect on more, and they're the ones that lead me to try and work out, well, how do I change this to be better? And so I think it's, again, there will always be cases that knock you around, but it's not a passive emotional blast. It's a conversion and a call to action.
Mm.
And I think that's the bit. Is what is it that we can do to make it better? And if the problems are outside of medicine, then some of the actions have to be outside of medicine. They have to be thinking about some of these issues in the wider system, because otherwise we're constantly going to be seeing the same old stories time again. But yeah, for sure, it's normal to have cases that will knock you around. There are cases whose names I remember 20 years later, and they usually represent something I learned a lot about at the time, but they also reflect the story I told myself about those cases at the time. And that's a really tricky one. If you think about a case that you remember, you're involved in that caused harm. And we asked people about this. I remember talking to a lot of people about this and saying, tell me how it felt when you found out about it. You know, that case you saw the other day. And there's usually different phases. First phase is usually surprise. Holy shit, really? I didn't. Oh my God, shock. The second phase is usually a challenge to sense of self. Shit, I thought I was good. I can't believe that happened. That was not what I intended. Holy shit, maybe I'm crap after all. I shouldn't have seen that. Oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And the third one is almost the most dangerous, which is I will never make that mistake again. And the difficulty with that is it tells us more about the way we think about safety, which is that safety is this weird badness that happens, rather than it tells us anything about what was going on. If you thought the patient was going to go home, and die, or, you know, you wouldn't have sent them home. So the bigger question to turn this around is to say, what made what you did seem the right thing at the time? And could someone else in that same situation do the same thing? And that comes down to a lot more about understanding what's going on and having a bit of self-compassion about what was going on and what was driving those decisions and how you weighed things up. And very often we don't do that. We don't take time to say, tell me what was going on. What was happening here? What made you think that? We often just go up and say, don't worry, we'll make mistakes. And it sounds really nice and supportive, but actually it doesn't, because it reframes you in this bad thing you did that you caused this person's harm, rather than saying, actually, what was going on that made that seem the right choice? And could someone else reasonable, intelligent, compassionate, hardworking do the same thing? So it's a much more of focus about trying to understand why decisions make sense. And the times that I've really struggled with that, with cases in the past, have been because I've been really harsh on myself. I haven't actually lived. I've just been like, oh my God, I did this awful thing. But when I look back now, with the experience I had and the understandings I had, I have a totally different view on it, which is being a junior doctor looking after really sick patients with no support. There's nothing I could do. So you have quite a different lens on things. But I think until we embed that kind of systems thinking, then very often we'll tell ourselves stories that we flagellate ourselves for the next 10 years about a patient rather than actually learning anything at all. So the way we tell stories to ourselves and about each other, I think, is really important.
Can you tell us a little bit about that stage 3 where you said the most dangerous thing that we can do is tell ourselves that it will never happen again? How do we reframe it so that we're not thinking about it that way?
I guess the trouble is what we do is when we say, I made this mistake, I won't make that mistake again, it doesn't tell us about why it seemed the right thing. And so we haven't really learned. And so if that exact same situation comes up again, we won't make that same choice. But if the same context and conditions exist and we're trying to make another decision that's the same but not quite the same, we probably will make the same kind of mistake. And this is the difference between very obvious mistakes that people go, oh, I won't do that again, that's fine, that's repeated, and you shouldn't do those. But very often the mistakes we're making are emergent mistakes. They're things that are a whole lot of things coming together at once, a perfect storm, not a Swiss tune, it's a perfect storm of conditions. But unless we understand how those conditions affect us and how we make choices, then it's very likely that those same conditions come around. Well, we face a different scenario, but the conditions will still drive the decision-making the same way. It's not saying we should keep on making the same mistakes. It's just saying that we mistake. When we do that, we have an illusion that learning. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I mean, is when you're thinking about what a case like that, if any of you feel triggered about a case like that, come back and think about, well, what was going on at the time? Why did that seem the right thing? What else was happening? What was the support going on? What were the systems in place? What training did I have? How could I escalate that? Did I feel comfortable escalating that? You know, what was going on? And you'll see different things. Mm-hmm. And they're very common things throughout the system.
The situations I find the most gnarly are the ones where you've made a decision and there might have been an adverse outcome for the patient, but then 20 yeah. different doctors would have done 20 different things. And so there doesn't seem to be a consensus on what was right and wrong. And I think when it's that blurred and it's that gray, it's almost more difficult to tell yourself, like, maybe I did do the right thing or maybe I didn't.
But again, we're going to drive ourselves into binary. Was it the right thing or the wrong thing? If someone says it's the right thing, I can relax. But I don't really feel relaxed. I still feel bad. Someone says it's the wrong thing. Oh, yeah, that's how I felt too. I'm going to blame myself. But I also, it doesn't really capture it. It feels uncomfortable. So we don't actually like those divisions. And I guess one of the questions I have to people is to say, how can you be safely wrong? Not that I'm making the right decision or the wrong decision, but can I be safely wrong? Because the reality is, like real medicine, is about navigating risk and uncertainty. That's especially as a specialist. That we train for the right answers. You get the right answers, you get into med school, you get more right answers, you get through med school, you train pro, you pass an exam, more right answers. And then as a specialist, you're faced with this reality that there are no right answers. If there were easy right answers all the time, they would have already been done. So you're faced with this, how do I navigate uncertainty? And that's the nature of complex problems, is you are constantly navigating competing priorities and risks and trade-offs. And so for all of us, and I think for ED, we used to talk a lot about this, how do I be safely wrong if I'm sending someone home? And this is what I think should happen. This is how I would look if things go. If you see this stuff, then that's not as we think it should go. So we want to see you again. How do I be safely wrong? How do I have people around me who can say, that wasn't the plan we thought we were going to be following? Okay, we need to change something. And that's about being much more explicit about how we think things should go and also how they might go, what risk might happen.
I wonder, this is something that a lot of residents would struggle with, because it's not really something that's taught to us in medical school, especially navigating risk and thinking about adverse events and what can happen to patients and decision-making and in critical environments and in emergent situations. It's just not really something that's taught to you until you navigate it yourself. And then it's a shock to you that this happened. Yeah.
It's a shock to specialists too. I think one of the drivers of burnout is actually one of the potential problems of being a new specialist is the uncertainty. This is quite quite the only rational response to complexity is uncertainty. And the difficulty is when you think the uncertainty is because you don't know enough and you don't have the answers and you're not enough, then you mistake the complexity of problems for personal failings. And that can start a real loop of anxiety and a sense of personal doubt, rather than just going, it's uncertain, it's complex, and we need to try and muddle through. But we don't really teach that. Even our case-based learning and stuff like that says, here's what you should do. We have evidence-based medicine applies, and there's always a right answer. You just look at the RCTs, I'll tell you the answer. But that's not the reality we face with our patients. They can form the way we think about care, and they can form the tools we use. But they don't really tell you much about how do you navigate people with multiple problems and competing priorities, all these things. And I think very often we take that uncertainty that's inherent within what we do and we convert it to anxiety by a sense of personal failure. Or maybe it's just...
Yeah, no, it's very relatable. It's not just you. You know, I'm thinking about people who are keen or prospective ICU trainees or ICU applicants, and it sounds cultural safety and safety in the workplace is all really important components of intensive training, because you guys are dealing on it with a day-to-day basis and it's right on the coalface. But what are some other bits of advice that you would provide to people who are prospective applicants for ICU?
To say, I think those things are important wherever you work, not just ICU. For ICU, I guess is that the things we are looking for, we want people who understand that they're part of the team. For a long time, we had the superstar mentality, really good to come to ICU and deal with the ordinary cases and stuff. That's just not how ICU is. We want people who are aware of other people, who are into building teams and being part of teams, who have great communication skills, who have empathy for other people. And the technology is all cool and that, but it's technology for what? What purpose? So I guess is that intensive care can be many things. The advice I give to people from intensive care is do a run, see how you like it, work out why you like it. For most people, there'll be a period where they go away and think about it, come back, and that's okay too. The training schemes are difficult now. You have to almost finish one specialty to do ICU. Sole ICU training is now an option, which is great. It's very good trainees doing just ICU, but it does limit you in terms of maybe to the bigger centres for now, although that may change. But I think just spend time, get an ICU run if you can, get an HG run if you can. They're pretty competitive, unfortunately, but go and see what it's like. And remember that every ICU is different as well. They're not all the same. But think about ICU if you love being a part of a team, you like to deal with really big, nasty, scary patients. But more importantly, if you like dealing with families, you like dealing with other teams, brokering care, and that sort of communicating across the boundaries of different teams and stuff like that, that's a lot of the work as a specialist. As a registrar, there's a lot of service delivery, but as a specialist, it's a different job.
Absolutely.
I guess the main things I'd pass on to people is that be very careful when you're deciding about your career. Don't make the question too small. And very often we make the question, do I want to do ED or medicine as well? That run or this place or that place. Make the question bigger. What do I value? What do I want my life to be like? And then what aligns with that or moves me in the direction at the moment towards that? Understanding that it may change over time. So make the questions bigger and get away from this idea that I just have to find this one specialty. Second thing I guess would be to say is remember that in medicine, it changes as you go along. Don't feel you have to fit yourself into a specialty. You can always fit the specialty into you. And if you want to value something, if there's things that you think are missing in your specialty, you can do that. Or you can make it whatever you want. You have to do the yards to get through. But remember why, what you're trying to do and what's important to you. So don't feel you have to box yourself into the specialty. Make the specialty meet your needs as well. So that's why I say come back to your values and what does a good life look like for you? And that you'll find that opens up a whole lot more possibilities than you thought possible.
Thank you so much, Carl. This was really useful. And hopefully for everyone listening, this is going to be a useful episode just to hear about how intensive care works and their priorities and their values in ICU. And that transfers across many other specialties in the hospital as well. So thank you so much, Carl.
No worries. Lovely meeting you.
This podcast was made possible by the New Zealand Doctors President's Association Education Trust. Thank you for listening. Mā te wā.